killing dozens of men before they could even set foot ashore. One of the most dramatic episodes took place at V Beach, which was overlooked by well-situated Turkish trenches. A naval bombardment was supposed to suppress the Turkish defenses, but yet again it proved ineffectual. So the British had concocted a scheme to pack 2,000 men into an old cargo ship, the River Clyde, and then to run that ship directly ashore. In theory, the troops would then pour out of holes which had been cut in the side of the steamer and run down ramps right onto the beach. In practice, however, it turned into a death trap. When the men emerged from the ship, they ran straight into a thick hail of gunfire, and nearly all of them were cut down. The survivors huddled inside the ship until nightfall. On all the beaches, the attacking troops soon became bogged down in the rough terrain after they had made only minimal headway, and without achieving their objectives. The Turks, unexpectedly, put up a dogged resistance. They even launched a number of counterattacks, which caused them to incur heavy casualties as well. Both sides then dug in, creating elaborate networks of trenches. In some cases, these were only a few yards apart. The expedition that had been intended to break the deadlock of trench warfare in Europe had instead ended up replicating it, except now in the blisteringly hot Mediterranean sun. Over the next 2 months, the Allies would pour more reinforcements into these landing zones. The troops there lived a hellish existence. They were perpetually short of water and supplies. They were scrabbling dugouts into the hard, rocky soil, and they ended up fighting a fruitless series of back-and-forth battles with their Turkish opponents. Much of the fighting, which resulted in thousands of casualties, centered around unsuccessful attempts to seize some of those key points of high ground that they potentially could have just occupied on the first day, but had failed to. At the tip of the peninsula, there were three major offensives, which were known as the First, Second, and Third Battles of Krithia. And these did manage to slowly advance the British lines, but at an enormous cost in lives. With British progress in the south stalled, efforts were made to expand the pocket of territory held by the Anzacs, with similar results. But still, the Allies persisted, sending more reinforcements to Gallipoli. The last major offensive came in August, when Hamilton decided to try one more landing at a site north of the Anzacs, which was called Suvla Bay. In support of that landing, the Anzacs made several fruitless and tragic attacks, which were supposedly to draw the Turks' attention away from the new landings. Famously, in one of these, the Australian Light Horse Brigade lost three-quarters of its men in just a few minutes of suicidal charges against the Turkish trenches. 25,000 men succeeded in coming ashore at Suvla Bay, which turned out to be mostly undefended. But after initially gaining some ground, that offensive also degenerated into a stalemate. The situation dragged on into the fall, when harsh winter weather replaced the previously intolerable heat. Men now began to freeze to death, and frostbite was rampant. The Allies at last admitted defeat and began to organize an evacuation. In ironic contrast to the rest of this operation, the evacuation was meticulously planned and efficiently executed, with the men slipping away in successive planned waves. The retreat was accompanied by an elaborate campaign of deception, involving clever ruses such as time devices that would fire rifles in order to make the Turks think that the men were still there in their trenches. Although the Allies had feared that the evacuation would result in thousands of casualties, it was carried off with hardly any losses. Still, by that point, the bloodshed from the Gallipoli campaign was appalling. An estimated 25,000 British, 10,000 French, 7,500 Australians, and 2,500 New Zealanders had been killed. Out of roughly 500,000 soldiers committed over the course of the campaign, the total Allied casualties, including killed, wounded, invalided, and missing, amounted to nearly half, a quarter million men. Turkish records are more incomplete, but they likely suffered a similar number of casualties. Recriminations over the disaster resulted in several individuals being disgraced and losing their jobs. Hamilton was dismissed from his command just before the evacuation, and this fiasco effectively ended his military career. As the main architect of the campaign, Churchill also was the object of much opprobrium, and he was removed as head of the Admiralty. Now, his career, of course, would later undergo an astonishing revival, since he would go on to become the Prime Minister and would be revered as the staunch opponent of Hitler during the Second World War. Probably the person who benefited the most from the Gallipoli campaign was that Turkish commander who had taken prompt action to oppose the landings, Mustafa Kemal. Throughout the campaign, he would assume more and more of a principal role among the Turkish officers. And he would then parlay the fame and authority that he had gained at Gallipoli into a political career. After the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and later the Turkish War of Independence, he became the president of the new nation of Turkey. Known as Atatürk, he oversaw an ambitious program of modernization and secularization in Turkey, which, of course, he ruled until his death in 1938. One of the most interesting consequences of the disastrous campaign at Gallipoli was its effect on Australia and New Zealand. The bravery of their Anzac troops became one of the foundational blocks for these former British colonies in developing distinct national identities. The anniversary of the initial landings, which is known as Anzac Day, is celebrated as one of the most important holidays in both countries. Considering the enormous scale of losses incurred for absolutely no military strategic gain, the Gallipoli campaign has to count as one of the most lamentable military blunders. The entire episode constitutes a litany of mistakes to avoid. The expedition was flawed in its very concept. It was based upon unwarranted assumptions. It was completely unrealistic in its expectations. The planning was inept. The allocation of resources badly executed. Decisions such as sending inadequate minesweepers and overestimating the power of naval bombardment seem to have sealed the fate of the endeavor before they even departed England. Spending several months on a series of half-hearted and ineffectual naval attacks just gave the Turks ample time to prepare their defenses, and the final naval assault was a complete disaster. The land offensive was no better, crippled from the outset by a poor choice of commander-in-chief. The landings, with all their confusion and missed opportunities, revealed a number of glaring weaknesses in the planning and organization of the operation. Poor command and control, unclear objectives, mediocre officers, all contributed to the lack of success. Even at that stage, the Gallipoli campaign might have ultimately amounted to little more than a minor embarrassment. But the Allies' inability to admit their errors caused them to continue to pour huge quantities of men and resources into a project they should have known was doomed to failure. And a whole series of further unimaginative attacks just piled up the casualties while accomplishing little of value. If one is looking for some positive legacy to come out of this sad story, maybe the most one can say is that the identities of three countries of the modern world, Australia, New Zealand, and Turkey, could all be considered to have been forged in the crucible of the battles that took place in 1915 on the Gallipoli Peninsula.
Lecture 21, World War II, the Royal Navy goes down.
Britain's Royal Navy takes justifiable pride in its history of bravery, skill, and daring. But that impressive record is not without its blemishes. Two of the worst British naval disasters took place within a few months of one another during World War II, although in very different geographic settings. The first occurred in December of 1941 in the warm tropical waters off the coast of Malaya. There, Britain's newest, supposedly most technologically sophisticated battleship was easily and ignominiously sunk by Japanese bombers. Then, in July 1942, in the frigid, storm-swept Barents Sea north of Norway, an entire convoy of merchant ships was abandoned by its navy escorts, and most of them were sunk. The cause of this fiasco was premature panic over a threat that in reality did not actually exist. The ill-fated battleship was the Prince of Wales, and the doomed merchant ships were members of what was termed Convoy PQ-17. Let's look at these maritime misfortunes in more detail. Prior to World War II, Great Britain still ruled a mighty overseas empire, and all of these far-flung dominions were protected by the Royal Navy, which was dominant over the waves. The centerpiece of this fleet was its battleships, giant, heavily armored vessels sporting massive cannons. It was assumed that any future war at sea would be decided by lines of these impressive ships blasting away at one another with their enormous guns. Now, a few voices had begun to question the supremacy of battleships, warning that these leviathans were vulnerable to attack from the relatively new technology of aircraft. But still, most within the Royal Navy firmly believed that such mighty vessels could not be sunk by puny little airplanes. In the Far East, the most likely enemy was the Japanese, who were then undergoing a rapid program of building up their army and their navy. In this region, the linchpin of Britain's naval defenses was the island city of Singapore, which is located at the southern tip of the Malay Peninsula. Just before the war broke out, Britain had spent £60 million, a very large sum, maybe equivalent to something like $5 billion today, on constructing an elaborate naval base at Singapore and fortifying it. All of those defenses, though, focused on repelling attacks from the sea. But the planners didn't bother putting fortifications on the landward side because they thought that there the jungle was simply too thick for any attacking force to be able to come at the base from that direction. Huge cannons were installed that could only point out to sea, but they could not be turned to face the land. And, as it turns out, this was a serious error. As war with Japan loomed, Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of Britain, decided that a powerful squadron should be sent to Singapore. He rather optimistically believed that just the presence of a few of the vaunted warships of the Royal Navy would be sufficient to frighten the Japanese and to deter them from any aggressive behavior. He stated that the presence of a modern battleship exercises a vague general fear and menaces all points at once, and would exert a paralyzing effect upon Japanese naval action. The confidence of the British regarding the supposed quality of their weapons and the inferiority of the Japanese is summed up by a newspaper article of the time, which asserted that once these British ships had arrived, the Japanese Navy would not dare venture into the South China Sea. In fact, the arrival of some British battleships at Singapore would render the Japanese naval problem in the Pacific quite hopeless. Naval aviation is, of all its departments, that in which the Japanese fleet is weakest. Well, far from being weak, the Japanese had developed a number of aircraft that were considerably superior to those of their American and British counterparts. Nevertheless, the Allies stubbornly persisted in believing that the Japanese were just incapable of producing high-technology weapons, and thus they woefully underestimated their capabilities. At the outbreak of the war, the current British torpedo bombers were of a hopelessly antiquated open cockpit biplane design that really would have been much more at home in the skies of World War I. They were flimsy contraptions, barely capable of lumbering along at a maximum attack speed of maybe 100 miles an hour. The British complacently assumed that any Japanese torpedo bombers would be no better than or probably considerably inferior to these. In reality, the thoroughly modern two-engine Japanese torpedo bombers were well-armed craft that could dart down at their targets at a speed of 180 miles an hour. In training exercises, the British anti-aircraft gunners on the battleships had only practiced against their own feeble planes, and thus they were completely unprepared to deal with the much speedier and more deadly Japanese models. The newest member of the British battleship fleet was the Prince of Wales. It was part of the King George V class, which were designed to be the most sophisticated and technologically advanced ships in the fleet. The Prince of Wales was 750 feet long, it displaced nearly 45,000 tons, and it was manned by a crew of over 1,500 sailors. Its primary armament for fighting other battleships consisted of innovative quadruple main gun turrets with 14-inch cannons. The secondary armament, which was intended for use against both ships and aircraft, was composed of a brand new type of 5.25 inch guns in twin motorized turrets. The Prince of Wales had 8 of these turrets, which were supplemented by 4 specialized close range anti-aircraft guns, again of a completely new design. These were complex 8-barrel devices that, at least if they worked right, would throw up a wall of shells. The Prince of Wales also featured a number of innovations in its armor and design that were supposed to make it more resistant to torpedo attack. The Navy believed that the Prince of Wales represented the cutting edge of warship construction and that it would be more than capable of handling any threats by sea or air that it might encounter. On its Far East mission of intimidation, the Prince of Wales was accompanied by one of Britain's older warships. This was the outdated, but still quite fast, battlecruiser Repulse, which was a veteran of the First World War. The two ships arrived in Singapore on December 2nd, 1941, and they were designated Force Z. On December 7th, the Japanese launched their air attack on Pearl Harbor, and Japanese bombers decimated the U.S. Pacific Fleet of battleships. Other Japanese forces began attacks in the Pacific, including bombing Singapore and landing troops just to the north in Thailand. While Pearl Harbor really should have served as a warning about the vulnerability of battleships to aircraft, it was thought that it was not a representative case because the U.S. ships had been caught unprepared, tied up in harbor, and unable to move. Furthermore, most of the U.S. ships sunk at Pearl Harbor were of relatively older designs. So it was still thought that a true modern battleship, fully manned and with room to maneuver at sea, should be able to fend off attacking aircraft. Thus, the commander of Force Z decided to sail north and oppose the Japanese landings. Although some British planes were potentially available to provide air cover for the ships, the admiral made no effort to arrange for this. The Prince of Wales and the Repulse, along with a few small destroyers, left Singapore and began a fruitless attempt to intercept the Japanese invasion convoys. By midnight or so on December 8th, it was clear that they had been spotted by Japanese search aircraft and submarines, and the admiral finally came to the realization that they should head back to Singapore. Unfortunately, just then, a report arrived that Japanese troops were disembarking at a nearby spot on the coast. This report later turned out to be inaccurate. There was, in fact, no landing. But the British commander could not resist the temptation to check it out for himself. Therefore, rather than returning to safety at Singapore, Force Z reversed course and sailed towards the supposed landing site. It was a fatal error. Upon arriving there in the morning, they were met with a tranquil, empty beach. Even at this point, they could have turned back and perhaps escaped. But the admiral next chose to linger in the area in order to investigate a tugboat that had been sighted pulling a couple of barges. Risking two major ships in order to inspect such a utterly insignificant potential target was complete folly. Even if the barges were carrying Japanese troops, one of these small escorting destroyers would have been more than adequate to intercept and destroy them. This poor decision shows the British admiral's contemptuous disregard for the threat posed by Japanese aircraft, since he knew Force Z had been seen and would be attacked if it stayed in the area. Compounding these errors was the fact that they were within range of a British airbase and very easily could have summoned fighter planes to provide air cover against Japanese bombers. But the admiral sent no message, and these decisions sealed their fate. The first Japanese air assault came just before noon. A wave of planes dropping bombs was followed by a second with torpedoes. Those complex 8-barrel anti-aircraft guns, they turned out to be extremely prone to jamming. Of the four of those weapons carried by the Prince of Wales, one of them jammed no fewer than 12 times during this brief engagement, while another jammed 8 times, and this basically rendered their fire ineffective. Also, the unexpectedly fast-moving bombers threw off the gunner's aim and disconcerted them. Two torpedoes struck the Prince of Wales, and although the ship was, in theory, able to withstand such attacks with minimal damage, these two hits nearly disabled the ship. The first torpedo hit near the stern, bending one of the propeller shafts into another, and causing rampant flooding that spread from room to room along the course of the propeller shaft. The second torpedo exploded on the same side a bit further forward, and it just blew through the layers of defenses, resulting in more flooding. The ship's electrical system collapsed, and the entire back end of the ship was left without any power to operate vital equipment, such as the pumps, which might have removed the water. The flooding caused the ship to quickly take on an 11-degree list to one side, and that effectively incapacitated all of the 5.25-inch gun turrets, which, at that angle, could not be rotated against the force of gravity. So, in just seconds, the pride of the British Navy had been disabled by a pair of cheap torpedoes. Also, not one Japanese bomber had been shot down. Further attacks soon followed. In all, 85 Japanese bombers participated in the assault on Force Z. The Prince of Wales was struck by 4 more torpedoes. It lost all power and came to a halt and began to settle in the water. The ship would eventually take nearly 2 hours to sink, but it did go under. The Repulse fought valiantly, and the whole ship actually managed to shoot down a few planes before it too succumbed. Struck multiple times, the Repulse rolled over and sank just 11 minutes after first being hit. Of the approximately 3,000 men aboard the two ships, 840 were killed, while the rest were picked up by the destroyers. Only after the ships had already been fatally hit was air support requested. But the first British fighters were unable to reach the scene until the Japanese had all departed, and so they accomplished nothing. It was a stunning result, which really laid bare the new reality of war at sea. And that was that the day of the battleship had passed, and air power was now the dominant factor. Churchill recorded his reaction on hearing the news. He said, "I put the telephone down. I was thankful to be alone. In all the war, I never received a more direct shock. As I turned over and twisted in bed, the full horror of the news sank in upon me. Over all this vast expanse of waters, Japan was supreme, and we everywhere were weak and naked." The news would get even worse, since within 2 months, the Japanese would drive right through the allegedly impenetrable forest and capture Singapore from the weakly defended land side. Thus, Singapore, Britain's great fortress in the east, and the supposedly powerful naval squadron guarding it, had proven to be equally feeble and ineffectual in the face of the Japanese attacks. Britain's other main foe in World War II was Nazi Germany. In this effort, Britain was supported by its allies, the United States, and the Soviet Union. Earlier in the summer of 1941, Russia had been invaded by Germany and was now struggling to survive the Nazi onslaught. Vital to this effort were the weapons and other materials that Britain and the U.S. were supplying to their beleaguered ally. The main problem, though, was simply transporting the goods past the Germans to the Soviet Union. And the primary way in which this was accomplished was by dispatching convoys of merchant ships from England that would traverse the harsh Arctic seas and then dock with their precious cargo at Russia's northern ports, such as Murmansk. Because these convoys had to travel along the long coast of Norway, which was occupied at the time by the Germans, they were vulnerable to attack by German submarines, aircraft, and naval units. Accordingly, the convoys would often swing far to the north, above the Arctic Circle, skirt the edge of the ice pack, and then cut back in towards their destination. This route was fraught with dangers, not only from the Germans, but also the harshness of the climate. Particularly in winter, the conditions were appalling, with freezing temperatures, mountainous seas, and frequent storms. The convoys often had inadequate naval escort. They were beset from above by swarms of German bombers and from below by lurking wolf packs of submarines. All of this, though, was merely a prelude to the greatest fear of the sailors in these convoys. They lived in constant terror that Germany's powerful surface warships would venture out from their lairs in the fjords of Norway and ambush the convoy. While the destroyers, armed trawlers, and other small warships that accompanied the merchant ships were, at least notionally, equipped to combat submarines and planes, they would be completely helpless if confronted with the thick armor and huge guns of a German battleship or heavy cruiser. Of all these threatening German vessels, the most powerful and most dreaded was the Tirpitz. It was the mightiest battleship in the European theater, bigger and more heavily armed and armored than the Prince of Wales class of ships. The Tirpitz sported 8 gigantic 15-inch guns that could fling a 2,000-pound high-explosive shell over 20 miles. The Tirpitz was the second member of the Bismarck class of German battleships, and earlier in the war, the Bismarck itself had encountered the Prince of Wales along with the renowned and beloved British battleship, the Hood. In just a few minutes of fierce battle, and even though outnumbered 2-1, the Bismarck inflicted serious damage on the Prince of Wales and effortlessly destroyed the Hood. Later, of course, the Bismarck would be trapped and sunk through the concerted effort of multiple capital ships of the Royal Navy. Now, the nightmare scenario for British convoy planners was that the Tirpitz would lunge out from where it was hidden in Norway and slaughter an entire convoy, together with its escorts. While the sinking of the Prince of Wales had exposed the vulnerability of battleships to air power, the stormy and frequently foggy conditions of the Arctic Ocean meant that aircraft in this theater were often either grounded outright or ineffectual. The Arctic supply convoys began in September 1941. Outbound convoys were given the designation PQ along with the number of the convoy. By June 1942, 16 of these had been run with varying degrees of success. Some convoys made the journey with no casualties, while others suffered from U-boat and air attacks. Despite losing ships, the overwhelming majority of the essential supplies were getting through to sustain the Soviet war effort. On June 27th, 1942, the 17th of these, convoy PQ-17, set sail. It consisted of 35 merchant vessels escorted by 6 Navy destroyers and over a dozen smaller warships. PQ-17 traversed over two-thirds of its route without too much mishap. And it reached a point north of Bear Island. Thus far, three ships had been sunk by submarines and bombers. But on such a dangerous path, these were fairly acceptable and really expected losses. On the whole, the escorts were doing an excellent job of fending off German attacks. And an optimistic mood began to spread among the sailors in the convoy, that perhaps they would manage to achieve their mission without serious losses. Meanwhile, the Germans were toying with the idea of trying to intercept PQ-17 with the Tirpitz and some other heavy warships. They contemplated such an action with almost every convoy, but the plans rarely amounted to much because Hitler was extremely reluctant to risk his valuable lone remaining battleship. Repeatedly, the German ships would start to venture out, but then were usually quickly called back and the foray canceled. In the case of PQ-17, this is exactly what happened. The Tirpitz and its escorts left their anchorage, but several destroyers ran aground, and the ships were soon recalled and went back into hiding. The British regularly tried to track the German warships using reconnaissance flights. And one of these planes passed over the Tirpitz's anchorage and discovered that the Tirpitz had left its moorings. This news immediately touched off a great deal of frantic worrying among the British commanders at the Admiralty. The man in overall charge of naval affairs was First Sea Lord Dudley Pound. While Pound had had a distinguished career, unfortunately, by this point, he was simply not up to the task. He was elderly, in ill health. He was known for routinely sleeping through important naval meetings. And he was filled with dread of German sea power. At a fateful conference on July 3rd, he became obsessed with the fact that the whereabouts of the Tirpitz were unknown, and he feared that it might be heading towards the convoy. Even though some circumstantial evidence arose that suggested that the Tirpitz had, as usual, returned to its anchorage, Pound precipitously decided that he had to act on the assumption that it was on the way to attack PQ-17. This was a panicky and unwarranted decision. Believing that the best chance that the ships had for survival was for them to just scatter, he sent a shocking message to PQ-17 that read, "Immediate. Owing to threat from surface ships, convoy is to disperse and proceed to Russian ports." This was followed a few minutes later by another order reiterating, "Convoy is to scatter." Now, although no enemy was actually in sight, the escorting British warships regretfully had no choice but to obey their orders, to turn back for home and abandon the slow-moving and defenseless merchant ships to their fate. The wretched cargo vessels were still a full 600 miles from their destination in Russia, in a stretch of water that was known to be infested with German U-boats. They would now have to try their best to run this deadly gauntlet and make it to port. As you might expect, the result was a complete massacre. The jubilant German U-boats and the bombers pounced on the helpless merchant ships that basically had been presented up to them by Pound's order. The valiant merchant crews attempted all sorts of desperate strategies. This included some of them tried hiding among the ice floes, others tried sailing far to the east before cutting back towards the Russian ports, but most of them were ruthlessly hunted down. The Germans were absolutely incredulous that the Royal Navy had simply deserted its charges and all but served them up on a platter for destruction. In the end, 26 out of the 35 merchant ships, almost exactly 75% of the convoy, were sunk. If the Tirpitz had actually attacked, the outcome could hardly have been worse. Along with the ships and crews, their vital cargoes were also all sent to the bottom of the ocean. And the lost goods included 210 aircraft, 430 tanks, 3,300 jeeps and trucks, and over 100,000 tons of essential stores. This amounted to the waste of months' worth of industrial production. And the denial of these supplies to the Soviets at that moment when they were fighting for their very survival was crucial. The embarrassing debacle of PQ-17 caused the suspension of the whole convoy system for 4 long months. Pound himself was heavily criticized, and within a year, he had resigned, citing ill health. Both the sinking of the Prince of Wales and the disaster of Convoy PQ-17 resulted from bad decision-making and from misjudging one's opponents. While, admittedly, most navies were slow to appreciate the new danger posed by air power, the British grossly underestimated the competence of the Japanese, while at the same time severely overvaluing the abilities of their own ships and the intimidation effect that they supposedly would exert upon the Japanese. Once Force Z had set out, its commander persisted far too long in a poorly defined mission, and he showed terrible judgment in risking his valuable ships for negligible goals, all the while stubbornly refusing to make use of available air cover. Conversely, with PQ-17, the British fatally overestimated the aggressiveness of the Germans, and they were excessively influenced by their fears of the Tirpitz sorting out from Norway. While this was a legitimate concern, the obsession with this one ship warped their whole strategy, and it led to the awful decision to disperse the convoy unnecessarily. These catastrophes illustrate that even the best organizations can sometimes stumble badly, and this can lead to dreadful consequences. In this particular case, it led to the sinking of the Prince of Wales and the needless destruction of Convoy PQ-17.
Lecture 22. Dieppe Raid. Catastrophe on the beach.
On August 19th, 1942, Canadian and British troops staged an amphibious raid on the German-occupied French city of Dieppe. The attack on Dieppe had one of the worst casualty rates of any major operation during World War II. In a mere 6 hours, the Allied force of about 6,000 suffered 4,131 men killed, wounded, or captured, an attrition rate of over 68%. The statistics are even more appalling if one takes into account the fact that many of those who survived the expedition never actually disembarked from their landing craft as originally planned. In a number of cases, those units that did venture onto the enemy beaches were almost completely annihilated. For example, of the 553 men of the Essex Scottish Regiment who hit the beach at Dieppe, fully 501 were lost, an incredible casualty rate of 94%. Likewise, the Royal Regiment of Canada also suffered 94% casualties during the operation. Adding to the severity of the disaster was that, at least on the surface, the raid failed to accomplish any of its objectives. The invading troops were supposed to seize control of the entire town of Dieppe and surrounding areas, yet most of them never even made it off the landing beaches. The attackers were tasked with blowing up at least a half dozen German artillery batteries, as well as a radar station and a command post. But in the end, only a single group of guns was demolished. The invaders were meant to capture the harbor and take back to England a number of German landing craft moored there. But only a handful of men even got close to that target, and no vessels were obtained. The planners of the raid arranged for the biggest armada of Allied aircraft since the Battle of Britain, and these were to hover over Dieppe in the hope of drawing out and destroying a large number of planes of the German Luftwaffe. A major air battle did indeed occur, but it was the British who suffered far greater casualties, losing 106 planes versus just 48 on the German side. In total, the Allies lost over 4,000 men compared to fewer than 600 for the Germans. Why did the Allies undertake such an ill-fated raid? Part of the reason has to do with the broader political and military situation in 1942. Germany was then on the rampage, having conquered most of Western Europe, and its armies were currently pushing deep into the Soviet Union. The British were under intense pressure from Stalin to attack Germany from the west in order to take some of the pressure off the reeling Russians. Now, the British were not yet ready to open a second front by undertaking a major invasion of Western Europe. But they did decide to stage a number of quick hit-and-run raids against targets in German-occupied areas, including Norway and France. The most ambitious of these schemes was to assault and briefly seize the French coastal resort town of Dieppe, which was located just across the English Channel, and so was within easy range of British aircraft. Dieppe itself was not of any strategic importance. But in addition to the symbolic value of striking against Nazi-held Europe, the raid might provide a useful test of the Allies' ability to mount a large-scale amphibious landing against a defended target. Responsibility for these raids fell to a group known as Combined Operations, which was headed by the enthusiastic but maybe overly rash Lord Mountbatten. He lobbied hard to get his plan for an attack on Dieppe approved, and with Churchill's support, it was. Again, politics played a role in the choice of which troops would participate in the operation. By 1942, over 200,000 volunteer Canadian soldiers had arrived in England. But as of yet, they had not seen any significant action. To bolster morale and make the symbolic statement that all parts of the British Commonwealth were united in the fight against Germany, it was decided that Canadians would comprise the bulk of the invading force. There were also some British commandos, 50 American Rangers, and a handful of free French troops who would participate. The raid was set for July, and the men actually embarked on their ships, but bad weather caused a last-minute cancellation. A key aspect of these sorts of attacks is the element of surprise. But after the abortive attempt, this may well have been lost. While it might have been wiser to shift the target, at Mountbatten's urging, the raid was rescheduled for August. Its codename was to be Operation Jubilee. The goals of Operation Jubilee were always ill-defined, and the massive size of the raid was quite unusual. The immediate tactical objectives, which involved seizing the town, blowing up a few outposts, simply were not worth such a large-scale operation. Most of those goals would probably have been better achieved by the insertion of small, stealthy commando groups rather than by employing a massive frontal assault with thousands of troops as was planned. The curious nature of the venture is indicated by the rather oxymoronic description that was applied to it. It was called a reconnaissance in force. The true purpose simply seems to have been to find out whether or not the Allies were capable of mounting such an operation, and for its symbolic political value as a blow struck at Nazi-occupied Europe. To support the main attack on the town of Dieppe, no fewer than 6 subsidiary landings were planned against various points on the surrounding coastline. Most of these were intended to destroy large gun emplacements whose cannons threatened the primary invasion force at Dieppe. And these flank attacks were therefore timed to take place just prior to the main landing. To the east of Dieppe, these sites were designated Blue Beach, Yellow Beach 1, and Yellow Beach 2. To the west were Green Beach, Orange Beach 1, and Orange Beach 2. On the night of August 18th, over 250 vessels bearing the soldiers set out from multiple ports in England. The carefully crafted plans first began to go awry when the boats transporting the units intended to land on the yellow beaches ran smack into a small German coastal convoy. A confused but fierce gun battle erupted between the warships escorting the Allied troop vessels and their German counterparts. In the chaos, the troop ships became widely scattered. In the aftermath of the battle, out of the original 23 troop carriers in this group, 8 returned back to England with damage, 8 milled around offshore, unsure whether to proceed, and only 7 continued on towards the beaches. At Yellow Beach 1, 120 men struggled ashore and were instantly met with heavy opposition. They were unable to progress more than a couple hundred yards, and eventually all but one man were killed or captured. At Yellow 2, a single boat containing just 20 men managed to arrive at the beach. But led by a particularly enterprising officer, this tiny band disembarked and boldly headed inland towards their target. They actually reached it and actively sniped at the German battery they were supposed to destroy. But they were so hopelessly outnumbered that eventually they just had to return to the beach, reboard their craft, and escape. Just down the coast, at Blue Beach, a terrible disaster occurred. The roughly 600 men of the Canadian Royal Regiment came ashore on a narrow beach that was located below a steep cliff. Only a single ravine led up from here, and that ravine was thoroughly blocked by barbed wire and machine gun nests. The men were trapped on the beach by a substantial seawall which was topped with even more barbed wire. In its evaluation of Blue Beach, the official regimental history concluded that it would have been difficult to discover anywhere on the coast of Europe a less favorable place for an assault landing. With nowhere to go and completely exposed to multiple German machine gun positions, the men were mown down as soon as they stepped out of their boats. Over 90% of the regiment was wiped out. At the subsidiary beaches to the west of Dieppe, similar scenes unfolded. The troops who landed at Green Beach had been given an absurdly ambitious itinerary. They were supposed to seize the beach, clear the clifftops, capture a radar station atop them, destroy a German strong point, wipe out the Germans on the headland overlooking Dieppe, capture an airfield, destroy a gun battery, and finally attack the German divisional headquarters. As things turned out, they landed late, and most of them were deposited on the wrong side of the local river. Nevertheless, they bravely attempted to start fulfilling their objectives, and they managed to move a short distance inland. But they met with stiff opposition, suffered heavy casualties. So their advance stalled, and eventually they were just pushed right back to the beach. The only definite success took place at the Orange Beaches, where two groups managed to reach one of their targets. This was a German gun emplacement labeled the Hess Battery. It consisted of six 150mm cannons. The commandos engaged the battery's guards in a spirited firefight, and then they lobbed a couple rounds from a small portable 2-inch mortar at the German position. And a lucky shot hit some stored ammunition, and there was an explosion that knocked out the battery for the duration of the raid. All of these landings, however, were just intended as support for the main effort, which was directed right at the beach in front of the town of Dieppe. That beach was divided into two landing zones designated red and white. As this area was the focal point of all the German defenses, it amounted to a frontal attack on the most heavily fortified location. And one might well question the wisdom of the planners in choosing to throw the main body of their men directly into this well-prepared killing zone. The beach at Dieppe was overlooked both on the right and the left by high cliffs, which were bristling with German machine gun nests and concealed artillery emplacements. The beach itself was flat with no cover, and between it and the town proper was a wide, grassy esplanade. A double row of barbed wire, more than 6 feet tall, encircled the entire beach. The Allied troops would thus have to come ashore on a completely exposed beach that was overlooked on three sides by higher ground that was full of German troops, machine guns, and cannons. The one building on the beach was a casino on the far right side that was in the process of being demolished at the time of the raid. For an attack on this site to have any chance of success, the optimal method would entail first either destroying or capturing the gun emplacements on the cliffs. And in fact, the earliest plan had called for paratroopers to seize or knock out the German cannon batteries. This idea was later vetoed, however, and it was instead decided that the sites could be captured by troops landing from the sea and scaling up the cliffs. As we've seen, the majority of these attacks failed, so now the main force would come ashore in the face of heavy fire. Another good option would have been to suppress or obliterate these emplacements just before the troops landed using large naval cannon. This was a glaringly obvious step to take, and the planners had indeed asked the Navy to provide a battleship, or at least a heavy cruiser, whose powerful cannons could have smashed the German gun emplacements. But with the disaster of the Prince of Wales fresh in their minds, the Navy defiantly refused to contribute any major warship. And so the only naval gun support would have to come from the puny 4-inch guns of a handful of small destroyers. The same goal might have been accomplished by attacks from aircraft, which could bomb the German positions just before the soldiers came ashore. Again, this was clearly something that should have been done. But there was concern